Good afternoon. Welcome to the University of Melbourne and today's forum, Knowledge Precincts, Places and Partnerships for Learning. It seems particularly fitting for an event dealing with the role of place to begin by acknowledging with great respect the Wurundjeri people and the Kulin Nations of the Kulin Nations as the traditional owners of the land on which the university resides and to recognise their elders both past and present. This event is hosted by the University of Melbourne as part of its public lecture series, Australia's Role in the World, and the City of Melbourne's Knowledge Week. Following the forum, we invite you to partake in a walking tour of the Parkville campus and of Ormond College. With us in the audience today, we have representatives of the university, colleges, secondary schools, local and state governments, and architecture and design firms, many of whom have worked with the university. Today's forum looks at the developing relationship between three distinct yet overlapping educational territories, the city, the campus, and the college. Of central importance to today's conversation is the role of space and place in knowledge creation and sharing, the role of the city in fostering Melbourne's knowledge economy, and the role of universities and colleges in sustaining Melbourne's status as a knowledge capital. This event comes at a time when we're rethinking what constitutes a higher education and the environments in which higher education takes place. The Vice-Chancellor of the University of Melbourne, Professor Glyn Davis, has written, "Campus is a place to work out who and what we want to be." Yet recent press reports on developments in e-learning have questioned whether the campus as we know it will even continue to exist. In a new book, Alain de Botton claims, and I quote, "We have implicitly charged our higher education system with a dual and possibly contradictory mission to teach us how to make a living and to teach us how to live." I suspect that today's forum will touch on both of these matters. Our panellists today are Mr. Jeff Lawler, Professor Margaret Scheel, Professor Rufus Black. And in the course of their presentations, each speaker has been asked to share with us an image of what they believe to be an effective learning environment from their own physical domain. Our first speaker is Jeff Lawler from the City of Melbourne. Jeff is one of five directors reporting to the Chief Executive of the City of Melbourne. As such, he's a member of the City of Melbourne's corporate management team and is responsible for the performance of the City Planning and Infrastructure Division. Jeff joined the City of Melbourne in 1996 after 17 years working for the Victorian Public Service in a variety of heritage and urban planning roles. Jeff has been asked to begin his presentation by addressing the question, how can the university better serve the city to become a vibrant knowledge precinct? Please welcome Jeff.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. May I also acknowledge the traditional owners and join in Peter's recognition of that on behalf of the City of Melbourne. May I also point out to you that I have a couple of colleagues here who I'd like to acknowledge as well. Austin Lee is the manager of our City Research Branch, and Dr. Shireen Huda works in that branch and is responsible for putting together Knowledge Week. So if it wasn't for those two people, we wouldn't be here today. So I'd like to acknowledge them. Austin's branch is also the source of most of what I'm about to show and tell you. I'm not going to directly answer the question that Peter posed me, because I'm entitled to. But what I want to tell you about is the city in that triumvirate that we've been posed. What is the city and where is this learning place in the city? That's the physical manifestation of the City of Melbourne, almost. It's 37.5 square kilometres. But in reality, it is made up of about 800,000 people on an average day being in that space for a variety of reasons, and that number of people is growing. That's roughly one in six Victorians inside this small space. And essentially my thesis is all of that space is a learning space. The economy that we now operate in depends vitally upon interaction, exchange. Well, cities have always done that, you say, that's called trade. But increasingly, the interaction, the exchange, is between human beings sharing information. And it was interesting watching you all in the 10 minutes before we got started. I'll bet you all of you have learnt at least one thing from the conversations you were having with each other. And if that in fact is the case, then Knowledge Week has been successful. The economy of this place is $58 billion a year. And if you look at it in another direction, this is a result of Austin's work identifying particular activities that are occurring within that space. There are some very well-known clusters that we would say we can point at them. They're knowledge clusters. There's this place, this university, the broader Parkville Medical Research Precinct, the area around RMIT, the aeronautical and marine research cluster that's in Fisherman's Bend, and so on. The sporting clusters, which are very clearly part of Melbourne's competitive advantage. However, we'd say it's actually more subtle than that. This is a map that is showing the distribution of certain industry sectors. All of these industry sectors rely hugely upon the exchange of information and the act of learning in order to create value. In fact, from the surveying which Austin's team has been doing over the last 6 months or so in order to help us understand exactly what this knowledge economy is, we think that 28 billion of that 58 billion could be directly attributed to core or intermediate knowledge-based industries, many of which are represented here, but there are more. So, what's the key aspect of all of this? Well, the word that comes up again and again and again is collaboration. And creating the ability for collaboration seems to be one of the things that managers of place can do to allow that to happen. In fact, of the surveying that's been done so far, 60% knowledge sector employees have a bachelor's degree or higher, so many of those may well have been part of the community that exists in this and the other campuses. 26% of them are specifically involved, one quarter specifically involved in creating or generating knowledge. 21% transfer knowledge to others through teaching, and 48% use knowledge as a key enabler in their work. Many of them, 80% of that sector, have indicated so far that they collaborate with others in doing what they do. So those old ideas which were related to, I'd suggest, an industrial age of protection of knowledge in order to create value, which is then transformed into protection of place to keep the invader away, is gone. So the way in which people work, the way in which people generate value is very much associated with their ability to collaborate, so spaces must do the same. And here's one we all know which allows that. Inside and outside, in a very public high street of the city. It's informal. What are they learning from each other? Maybe they're learning about who won the footy last weekend. Maybe they're learning about what each had for lunch. But they're all there with a common purpose, and it might simply be to rest or enjoy the sun. But that common purpose then enables the possibility for other things to happen. As you go through the city, you'll see scenes like this. What are they collaborating, learning about? We might have called it gossip. Others would call it current affairs. It's exchange. It's deal making. It's understanding the context within which you operate. It's knowing. It's doing the SWOT. You know, what's the operating environment? All of this stuff is incredibly important and valuable. Innovation then comes from that. Here's an example of somebody who's figured out a way to have a temporary use in one of the back street lanes. wonderful, something everyone can flock to because it's different, but it's inclusive. There are no real barriers to this because there's no real walls. It's inclusive, and that creates that opportunity. And I'm going to finish with this image, which might be an interesting harbinger of what cities might mean in the future in this space. This is Tech Shop, a brand created in San Francisco as a not-for-profit to enable people through a subscription arrangement to access very expensive machinery to do things like 3D digital printing, to talk to each other, but actually to create maquettes or other models of whatever it is that they think they can contribute to society. Is this the sort of shop front of a city in the future where people are physically creating and exchanging information? I think it might be.
Thank you, Jeff. Our second speaker is Professor Margaret Scheel, who joined the University of Melbourne as Provost in April this year from her former role as CEO of the Australian Research Council. As Provost, Margaret leads the development and delivery of the Melbourne Curriculum, Melbourne Student Services Model, and Scholarly Information Future. And of particular importance to me, she leads the development of new learning environments within the university campus. The Provost is the university's Chief Academic Officer and Standing Deputy to the Vice-Chancellor. Please welcome Margaret.
I'm going to answer the question particularly well either, but I thought I might just touch on a couple of key concepts and happy to expand on them as we go into the discussion and talk about some of the new ways in which we're acquiring knowledge, some of the ways that demand is being generated for knowledge, how we can better do and facilitate knowledge partnerships, and then finish with a little bit of an answer to the question about how we can perhaps encourage partnerships and also encourage and create wonderful spaces. So this, you don't need to worry too much about the detail of this, but this is almost becoming, I guess, an iconic slide in relation to the new Melbourne curriculum. And the reason I don't want you to engage with the detail. What I want you to take away from this message is something about the complexity. Just trying to see whether I have a pointer here. I do. So this, slide shows are these yellow dots are the six broad-based undergraduate degrees that were introduced at the time we reformed the curriculum to put to introduce broader-based undergraduate degrees with specialist graduate programs. And what the other dots represent are the pathways of the graduates from those degrees. And the dark lines just give you a sense of the volume. And the message to take away here is just how diverse this is. So that from these six degrees in science, arts, commerce, music, environments and biomedicine, the students are going into a whole range of different graduate programs, you know, from teaching through to medicine, through to allied health programs, to law and so on. So it's just telling you something about the way the students have responded to that change in the curriculum and also how diverse our student body is now, and that they're no longer organised into what was 96 lots, I guess, if we think about the 96 degrees that preceded this change, some of which were double degrees, but there was a sort of an organisational unit through which we could manage cohorts, expectations, careers and so on. We now have a very, very, very diverse exciting, I guess, model of delivering education that the students have responded to, but it brings with it different challenges in terms of trying to get students together to because we don't have that old sorting mechanism of the 96 degrees. The other development that I'll just touch on briefly, and So many of you will have heard a lot about this in the press and are experiencing some of this yourselves. And this is the demand for knowledge that's being generated by the availability of knowledge online. And the New York Times described 2012 recently as the year of the MOOC. And the MOOC is the massive open online course. And these came out of, so these are free courses online offered by the best universities of the world. They came out of computer science departments, interestingly enough, in MIT and Stanford, and they've generated a tsunami of interest in online education. So, and there are a range of these. There's one involving MIT, Berkeley, Harvard, and now a number of other partners. There's a group that's spun out of Stanford called Udacity, led by Sebastian Thurn. And there's a there's a number of others, but the one that's of most interest to us is also came from Stanford, and it's known as Coursera. And that started with three or four institutions in April of this year. It then moved to added a further 17 partners in July and a further 16 partners, including the University of Melbourne, in October. And so they started in April, and there's over 1 million students using their platform and accessing their courses. We haven't started yet. We joined the consortium. We've put up 7 courses on the website and indicated what they would be, and we've got 50,000 enrolments already. They'll start in March next year, and that's more students than we have here on campus. So the demand for these massive open online courses has I think exceeded everybody's if anybody could have conceived of that demand, it's exceeded expectations, and it's and there is a drop off rate, so that, you know, there's 100,000 enrolled in week one, there's maybe, you know, in some courses 2,000 enrolled in week 13. There's evidence already that, you know, short courses are better. We know, but you know, that there are a whole range of issues around credentialing and what these courses will mean for universities. But it's the scale of this activity. It generates a range of opportunities. It generates opportunities in terms of what we're learning about how we teach. So if you have 100,000 students doing a course and 10,000 get the same wrong answer, you're pretty confident that maybe you did something wrong, not the students. It's giving an opportunity for people to taste or to get a sense of whether they're interested in changing courses. The demographics that we're learning about, the sorts of students that may be enrolled in these courses, are incredible interest to educators around the world. They're later, generally, older, more mature age students, potential students, or, you know, working people, retired people. You know, it's not actually the undergraduate looking for a replacement undergraduate experience as such. And we don't know where this is going to go. And you have to put it in context. We've got 7 courses up there. We offer 5,300 on campus. So it's not going to completely replace the Melbourne curriculum. But it will create an awareness and generate more demand for education, we think. And that's everybody, all the research about what happens in the online world is it actually creates demand for a physical experience alongside that. So that's a development that we're part of, that we don't know where that's going to end up, but it's certainly been the one that's generated the most interest in education this year. And one of the reasons I think we can be confident that we won't replace, I think, higher education institutions with a completely online world is that education is inherently a social experience. So one of the reasons the MOOCs have been popular is underneath the courses that are offered are a whole range of chat groups from around the world where students are sharing online. But we don't anticipate that that will remove the need for students to share and have a social experience. This is one of the many wonderful learning spaces that we have here at the University of Melbourne, which Peter has been hugely influential in developing. And I chose this one of the range of slides that Peter sent me for a particular reason, is what you see here is that the students are not in formal classes, but they're all working on campus together, sharing knowledge and studying together. And every slide that Peter sent me, and I was only allowed to use a limited number, but I could have shown you many more of these, where these wonderful spaces we've created here have created these kind of communities. But the one that the reason why I chose this one in particular is if you look at what these students are doing, this space was probably 2 or 3 years old, maybe 4 years old. And in each of those spaces, we've provided a computer. But if you look at what the students are doing, none of them are using the computer that's provided. They're all using their own devices. They're not talking to one another. They're sitting working, so there's a social aspect to that. They might talk occasionally, but none of them are using the fixed computer. So we're in a bring-your-own-device world as well, which we need to respond to. So it's not about just having computer labs anymore. It's about having spaces and being able to connect seamlessly those devices. This space, which I wanted to use to introduce the concept of knowledge transfer and research precincts, is actually from MIT. And walked through this space when I visited recently. It's the ground floor of a building. I wasn't even sure what the building was. And it had an open space that the general public could walk through. Again, you didn't really know what the building was there for because there was no sign that said genetics or whatever. But as you walked through the space, there was the research and activities and the research prominence of MIT was on display. So there were these glass cabinets where you could peer in and learn about a particular discovery. There is a whole range of artwork that's been generated from scientific slides, so, you know, cells, protein structures and so on. There's timelines on the wall about the development of the technology that ultimately led to sequencing the human genome. And it's just a kind of flow through open to the rest of the city space that's a passive knowledge transfer space. We know, and Jeff's touched on this, that connecting people in research environments into precincts, into common spaces, into creating opportunities for casual exchanges has a big impact on science and research and the capacity to do that in a great way. And we have many examples of that here in Melbourne and in Parkville, and I'll just reflect on one of those opportunities. When I was in my former job, I was involved in discussions around funding the Bionic Eye. Earlier today, we've had an event around celebrating some of the milestones of that project. When I arrived here, I said to someone, how could you do that? You know, why could we get going so quickly and make such rapid progress in an important problem? And in part it was because there was learnings from the bionic ear, but it was in part because all the elements to tackle this really important and challenging problem were here. We had ICT expertise in NICTA, we had the Bionic Ear Institute, we had the hospitals, we had the neuroscience, we had all the elements here. So when the thought of developing and tackling such a big problem was brought to bear, all the elements were here and they were accessible and they were able to get together and make very rapid progress. So I've got to finish because Peter asked me to reflect on something that we could do better. and so I'm reflecting on one of the challenges that I found in terms of visiting the University of Melbourne when I wasn't part of Melbourne, the city or the university. It's very difficult to identify what's the, you know, if you said to a taxi driver, I want to go to the main entrance of the University of Melbourne, I don't think anybody could find it because, you know, it's not clear what where it is. So this is the entrance that you get if you travel from the tram stop. And I wasn't here at the time, and I know, and I'm a little nervous about trams, so I focused a little bit because I didn't grow up with trams, and there's these big signs about, you know, hippopotamus hitting you and so on, so they make me nervous. But so I think about the tram stop a lot when I get off the tram there, and I said to someone the question about one of my colleagues about the entrance, you know, that there's no main entrance, and he said, well, Think about what would have happened if we'd put the tram stop 100 metres further to the north, that this we would have walked in every morning and our 70,000 open day visitors would have walked into this vista rather than the one 100 metres to the south. So that's an opportunity and a challenge, I think, for us all collectively to work on creating these kinds of vistas that are open, that create the message that the university is a place where everyone is welcome and where you might actually be engaged and walk through and acquire some knowledge. Thank you.
Thanks, Margaret. Our final speaker is Professor Rufus Black, who was the Master of Ormond College. Rufus is an ethicist, a theologian, and a strategic advisor. Before becoming Master of Ormond, he worked at McKinsey & Company for 9 years, where he was a partner and played a leadership role in the firm's organisation and public sector practices in Australia and Asia. He continues to provide strategic advice to leading Australian corporations and government departments. Rufus is also an ordained minister of the Uniting Church of Australia, and he's currently chair of the board of Teach for Australia, a board member of New York-based Teach for All, and a board member of the Business Working with Education Foundation. I'm delighted to report that Rufus also recently led the multi-award-winning redevelopment of the Ormond Library to form a wonderful new academic centre for the college, which you will have the opportunity to visit at the end of this forum. We asked Rufus to begin by reflecting on what could we take from the college student experience to enhance the student learning experience in the city and campus environments. Rufus.
Peter, thank you. The first thing about lessons is you learn them from people, and I have had great teachers. Peter, our wonderful architects who've worked with us, John Lee, who's been one of them, is here today, and of course, our students have been my great teachers in what makes terrific learning spaces for the world today. And so Peter asked me to start with an example of what I think is a great learning space, and it is where we as a college began our renewal of learning spaces, and it is with a cafe. And you'll see that there is learning already very vibrantly happening, as it happens in cafes across the town. If this is the year of the MOOC, I think it's also the year of the end of the lecture theatre, and let us celebrate that. There may well be sort of theatre-like lecture theatres for public performances, but for the transmission of knowledge, their age is done. The age of the cafe is here, and the age of the informal spaces to connect and engage in conversation. I look forward to the bulldozing of many lecture theatres at the university and the erection of far more engaging human places where conversations can occur. Because as we've heard today, learning doesn't occur in defined times or structured places. It occurs when learners are stimulated by the people around them and the environments that they're in. For some purposes, those need to be a little bit structured if you're doing scientific experiments of various kinds. But the rest of the time, they need to be great places for terrific conversations with the people who will make your life larger. That's the beginning of great learning spaces. And so when we set about to design this space, the other thing is they need to be built around the way people know how to do those best. When we redesigned this cafe to be a great learning space, I took a group of students, well actually, they took me, on a cafe crawl of Melbourne's best cafes as they saw them. We made notes, we took lessons, we decided what the best features were that made for the spaces where all of that kind of activity would happen. Then they sat with me and we invited 6 of the leading architecture firms in Melbourne to come and talk to us. They were a little surprised to find a group of students at the head of the table. But we then selected a terrific firm who did a wonderful piece of work with us, which were Nest Architects. But while I'm on conversations, there of course is the new and the old. And one of the things that our students will tell us about great learning spaces is that this is perhaps our greatest learning space, our dining hall. Why? Because this is the way in which a community actually engages in a serendipitous set of conversations with people where there's a sufficient level of trust that those conversations can actually get to some level of depth. What is occurring in these kind of spaces is a structured way in which a community enables the serendipitous to happen across faculties, across age groups, across year groups. Those kind of spaces are vital. We've always had them. And our real effort has simply been to celebrate them and to celebrate the absence of devices. You will rarely see devices occupying people in these spaces because these are the spaces for the truly human moments, which I think are at the heart of genuinely transformational learning moments. So if we are not to have lecture theatres, and there is a limit to the number of dining halls, and I would invite the university to think about how you reconfigure spaces. On my list of spaces in the university due for some major innovation would be the CAF, which remains one of the most dismal spaces for learning in an academic institution, and it should be one of the most vibrant, because we can create great modern places for eating. So if it isn't about lecture theatres, what kind of spaces is it about? Well, I think it's about this kind of space. This is our new academic centre, which you'll get to see, a wonderful collaboration with Peter and John and his team, where we've really built it around all of the different ways in which students get together and learn. And so what I want to do is to talk about what are the lessons we've learnt from this, what's guided us. First, in this slide, I want to talk about four ideas. Specificity, tense, trust, and haphazardity, which have guided us. Specificity, because you design spaces very acutely to get people to do what you want them to do in those spaces. I think the age of the multi-purpose space is over. What we know is that we can create beautiful places which will enable the rich kind of activities to happen. Whether it is the kind of learning around the cafe-like table that you insert in a library or the well-designed booth that enables collaborative use of information technology. These require fine-tuning. We discovered it's a millimetre exercise. You measure booth spaces that work on campus versus ones that don't. It's a matter of a centimetre or two between success or failure. It is about specificity and getting it right. It's also about tents. One of the things that this space has is it's an internal room within a room. You can create rooms within rooms where different kinds of learning can all happen under one overall roof. It's also about trust. What this space has is very high quality materials. We made the architects work hard on the overall structure so we could spend money on materials that are very high quality, and they are enormously respected. If you trust people with great spaces, they respect them and use them. They use them well. The other thing is about haphazardity, which is the sense that you can feel the time-worn materiality of things. The recycled timber table here, the use of materials, invites people to recognise they are not in a sterile, eternal now, but they actually belong to a larger narrative, to a place that has a story that connects them to each other and them to a wider narrative about the place, about learning, about knowledge. In many ways, it is what makes for placefulness. And so the haptic's important that we bring it back. Why do people love the old colleges? Because they have a sense of haptic place about them. But that can be done again today. Other things that we learnt in creating these spaces, I think, are about three other ideas that are captured in this slide. One is about sculpture, the other is about rhythms, and the final one is about beauty. The first is about sculpture. One of the things that I think worked extraordinarily well here was that we took utilitarian things and sculpted them into objects that became part of the learning space. One of John's team had the brilliant idea to stop treating bookshelves as some kind of warehouse for books, but literally as objects for sculpture that we could turn into places where you could not only display knowledge, where students can sit, and where vistas could be opened to the outside to bring the outside world in. A once enclosed roof was revealed, and its utilitarian glory becomes part of connecting people to the outside world. Virtually every aspect of this space is not utilitarian. It does something to engage people with it. The other thing is about rhythms. This is a lecture theatre's, one of the many reasons they are awful is they disconnect you from the rest of the rhythms of the world and of life, and so many spaces do. And yet we are inherently rhythmic creatures whose learning should be shaped and structured by that, to bring the sense of the changing pace and light and quality of the day and of the year into the learning space. Our building does that in a series of remarkable ways, not least by having light comes through the roof, it tracks like a sundial through the building, and people have a real sense of the day. They're connected to the outside, and it's task lit, so that we're not pretending it's an eternal daytime when you're learning, but you're actually connecting with what's going on about you. That's what makes these places human, and therefore human things happen in them. And the final thing is beauty. Beauty matters. We should be committed to it in universities. Universities are some of the most beautiful places in the world, and I think it's for good reason. Mario Botta observed, the wonderful Italian architect, that museums are the cathedrals of our time because they're the last place where value can be contemplated. Universities should be beautiful places because beauty lines up with truth and goodness as one of the three great things that universities should be inquiring into. You can't inquire into beauty if you are not in a beautiful place. So I think they should be places of beauty, and we should be committed to that. It also means that if they are beautiful, we are in conversation with things about value. And if I'm sad about things that have happened at this university at times, it is not enough of our new building is genuinely beautiful in provocative and interesting ways that invite people into a conversation. We have built too many utilitarian commercial buildings around this campus. We need to stop that and build spaces that genuinely engage people in a values-based conversation. And then I think the final thing about beauty is it leaves you with a reservoir of memories so that when you do journey out into a darker and more challenging world, you carry with you a reservoir of memories about what it is to be in a beautiful place. And I think that enriches people for the rest of their lives. The final thing is it's not only about buildings. We mustn't neglect our gardens as places of learning. They are so important, not only because they do so much to connect us with rhythm and nature and the environment, which surely is part of a good education, but also because we connect and relate to each other in different ways in garden spaces. This university had its systems garden as a key feature of the early part of its life, and it has retained garden spaces. We need to nurture them and open them up at every possibility. I'm inspired by New York's scheme to kind of turn footways into new kinds of public parks. And I'm delighted at the work that the City of Melbourne is doing in renewing our public parks and spaces. I think the university should be embarked in capturing and creating as many green spaces for people to stop and pause and learn as it possibly can. So a few of the lessons in the 10 minutes Peter politely allows that come from these great collaborations with people whose partnerships with them I have so deeply appreciated. So Peter, to John, to our friends at Lovell Chen and at Nest, my thanks for all that you've taught me.
We'd like to move now into a conversational stage of the forum, and I'll start the panel thinking and hopefully responding, and I'd like each of the panel members to respond to this prompt, if you like, before we take some questions from the audience. How we define a knowledge economy or the knowledge sector will determine who and what are seen to be vital to its development and what isn't. So I'm interested in who we leave out of the picture. I'm interested in how inclusive the knowledge economy that we're aiming to build, and it's clearly being built at the moment, how inclusive it will be, and who may get left out of that process and not be part of the knowledge economy.
Well, if I could respond by saying, I guess from a risk perspective, you can't leave anybody out. Now, easy to say, a bit harder to do. But you simply can't, because ultimately that will bring the whole to an end. It is a key point of unsustainability, that if it's not inclusive. There are some signs of hope, I think, for making that better. I mean, simply the sheer numbers that I've shown you, at least for the City of Melbourne, which has had an urban policy about inclusiveness for as long as I've worked for it, the numbers are coming. So clearly it's working at that level. What do things like the rollout of the NBN mean, for example, in the future? I hope it furthers it. Inclusive not just to the people that you go to work with or live near, but the world. It's It's something that just has to be worked at.
Is there a danger, Jeff, in that some of the places that have been developed very successfully in the city over the past few years and that attract me and my friends and my sons these days, that they in some way don't welcome all citizens or all users of the city?
Yes, there are some dimensions of the city that do that. In fact, it's been quite a problem in recent times, and I'm referring specifically to the late night economy. Those 800,000 people that are in the city on an average workday, on an average Friday and Saturday night, in recent times it's been up to 300,000 people in the city, and many of those are here for a single purpose. You've seen the results of single purpose late at night, alcohol fuelled. At times, the streets of the city have looked like a war zone. Now, that has dissipated, but I suppose the key point, and the point that the council is wanting to address, is that singularity is a huge risk. Diversity is the best way of overcoming that risk. So the ability to create reasons for people to be together from a very diverse walks of life is a key success factor.
Thanks, Jeff. Margaret, could I get a response from you to the issue about whether we're going to exclude people?
Well, I think it's quite a tricky question, Peter, but we've got to, I think, show, you know, the access is access and equity is another one of my areas, portfolio areas, and what we are seeing now with the opening up of this brief period, I suspect, of opening up universities to the unmet demand, is that we're quickly reaching the point where that, with the current school system and the current support mechanisms in place, getting a university place is no longer an issue. What the issue and the challenge shifts to a much earlier place in schooling for those groups that we know that are underrepresented. And, you know, the Indigenous community is an area where we continually, I think, have not solved many of the challenges there. So we have very good support mechanisms here. We've got a range of interesting programs with the colleges, but the issue goes much earlier in education. And so I think we're going to see, if you compare our rate of higher education to, say, Taiwan, where it's 96% of the population in a certain age group has access to university education, we're going to have to shift some of our thinking if we want to create greater access to an earlier place in education.
Rufus?
Peter, a couple of thoughts. If we're going to be inclusive, our spaces have to be democratic places where anybody is welcome. I think the City of Melbourne on a global scale doesn't do too badly in this because it's so committed to opening up the interstices of the city to a wide range of different kinds of activities and people, and that I think makes it a more welcoming city. I think we do need to make sure that democratisation also enables learning to happen. We are still a city that is poor compared to cities around the world in terms of the ubiquity of publicly available Wi-Fi, where people might engage in kind of where all of those learning activities can be drawn into a much broader set of spaces. So I think there's still substantial work to be done in terms of how we, if this is the year of the MOOC, then we've got to do lots more to create the public places where people come together. This city has an enormously rich history of public learning institutions, the mechanics institutes of the 19th century. I think we need to be reinventing what is the 21st century version of the mechanics institutes, which are places where people from all walks of life are coming together to do learning. So I think we need to learn from Melbourne's remarkably democratic learning past in terms of its spaces, to be thinking about what more we do in the city and what more the universities can be doing to collaborate with the city in the creation of those more democratic learning spaces.
Thank you. Oh, sorry, Margaret.
I just want to add something. Yes. Had I not been restricted to 6 slides, the slide that I deleted, Rufus, was of my online learning team accessing the publicly available Wi-Fi outside the Seinfeld Cafe in New York, and that's clearly an issue that other global cities have grappled with and are working to solve. And you know, I speak from a position of weakness here in relation to the university's Wi-Fi, but it's something the demand is going to be stronger and stronger, and you know, it's not just about fixed line.
Could I go back to that tech shop thing by my slides? So I think there's a really interesting development. I think there's about 6 of them so far, and it's being created, like a lot of American things are, sort of brand style. But the really interesting thing about it is that it's creating an ability for people to engage with the digital economy using their hands to make things. And I think we have been a little bit at risk of losing the ability to make things. It's kind of been this sort of reduced down to what you think, what you say, what you might write. But if we can't make things, you're just missing a bit in the total learning. And this gives, this shop gives an ability for people who wouldn't have the resources to otherwise make things in the 21st century to do so. I think that's fantastic.
Certainly. Could I invite questions from the audience to the panel, please? And if I could just ask you to wait until the roving mic reaches you. We might take a question from the woman in the blue and white striped dress there, if I may. And then the gentleman to the right.
Very selective about the question I'm asking. I've got hundreds of questions in my mind, but the one I want to address is the situation that many of us, especially females, face when we park our car, when we are fortunate enough to park our car in one of the side streets, and then we finish, say, at 7:30 or at 8 o'clock and we need to proceed to our car. Now, the City of Melbourne has done wonderful things around the Crown Casino. It's doing wonderful things with lighting in Chinatown and around the theatres. But there are still extremely dark spots around the campus. And, of course, that links with the question of free parking or meter parking, which, if we are going to get people to have this campus experience, we may need to think about.
Thank you. Panel members, I'd like to lead off with a response.
Could I just clarify? Is your concern about on campus or off campus?
Off campus street parking and moving from the campus to the parking area. And of course, there are some very dark spots on campus, and I do know that we are into the age of sustainability as well. But my concern is with the City of Melbourne and the lighting and the parking provisions.
Thank you.
Well, from the City of Melbourne's point of view, we recognise that good lighting is a critical part of safety. Safety is a critical part of a successful city. So we are continuously looking at upgrading it and finding less energy-intensive ways of delivering the light. So happy to take on board where the dark spots are. In terms of parking, this is a sort of tricky issue for a growing city. Of that 800,000 people that are coming in every day, about 380,000 of them are coming in for a traditional commuting working experience. And about 80% of those are these days travelling by public transport. The remainder of visits during the course of the day are essentially short-term business visits. So the on-street parking is distinct from the off-street parking, which the council predominantly does not own or control. But the on-street parking is reserved very much for those short-term business visits, and it's simply a fact of numbers and space that not everybody should be thinking that parking on street is one, sustainable into the long term as an option for how this city operates, or two, going to be necessarily the best way of getting to and from here in the future?
I think we, unless you have a particular urge to answer that question, we might just leave it with Jeff, given it seems to fall into his domain. We have a question over on the right thing.
Thank you. Luke Flanagan from Property Campus Services here at the University. My question is specifically for Jeff, but also further to comments made both by Margaret and Rufus, with reference to both creating and reinvigorating green spaces, but also the presentation of the university campus or campuses. The university is obviously an integral part of Melbourne's knowledge precincts, primarily at Southbank and here at Parkville. Just interested to know what sorts of opportunities you think there might be as far as integrating those campuses into the cityscape with, to my mind, the obvious candidates are things like the closure or a cut and cover tunnel under Grattan Street, for example, as the university moves southward, but also closure of streets like Dodds and Grant Street at Southbank, which I understand are currently ideas that are at least being contemplated.
I guess that's me again. The City of Melbourne is well aware of the university's desire to traffic calm Grattan Street, and there clearly is an argument for that because the university is now equally on either side of Grattan Street. And that's a great thing that the University of Melbourne has actually stepped out of its 19th century walls and moved into the city. Just as RMIT has turned its face back towards the city over time and moved northwards. There are, however, 20,000 vehicles a day going down Grattan Street at the moment, and until an alternative is found for what to do about that, it's a little difficult.
I think the thinking obviously needs to be in terms of the coming decades. It's not something that's going to happen necessarily in the next 5 to 10 years, but if we take the long-term perspective, the university's obviously been here for 150 years. If we contemplate, you know, opportunities that can be considered, you know, with a long horizon, obviously there's clearly potential there longer term.
Yeah, there's no question of that, but it does depend on some reasonably substantial infrastructure changes. I mean, one of the things that is planned to happen, subject to government decisions on when to go and how to finance it, is a new metro rail system passing through this area with a railway station in and around the intersection of Royal Parade and Grattan Street. Now, if that happens, you will have a major major transport interchange at that corner. And Margaret won't have to show slides about the tram stop in Swanston Street. Incredible amounts of people into the future in that corner. So it of itself will start to drive the sort of changes you're talking about.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Question over here in the middle.
Jeff Robinson from Oricon. I was interested to hear what you were saying about, Rufus, about the death of the lecture, the theatre this year. I mean, maybe we should go around and sort of put little signs on saying rest in peace or something. But I suppose I'm just interested to know, I go to lots of conferences and I hear a lot about the new learning techniques and things like this and about the death of the lecture theatre. But they all seem to be held in lecture theatres, by the way. But anyway, putting that aside, I'm just interested in understanding what the university's policy is, and where, you know, are the good examples that can be pointed to in other parts of the world about redeveloping lecture theatres and using them in different ways. Because certainly, I think that the collaborative spaces that you have created are absolutely world class, but it's that reconfiguration and what the plans are for reusing fairly expensive infrastructure.
Well, it'll be easy for Margaret to say what the university's policies are. My world ends at our gate. What I do think is inspiring, though, is to have a look at what they've did at where they've been heading at MIT, which is probably, I think, cutting edge in this in these kind of spaces, which are once you start closing lecture theatres, you can start recreating collaborative learning spaces where you know you still have large numbers of students together, but they are really are configured so that learning can happen differently. And I think the revolution that that needs to happen is actually about how we teach. And space should follow that. It's a sort of catastrophic failure of the imagination that we still continue to conduct learning in these kind of in these formats where we know how much better it can be done. The other place universities can look is to some of the most innovative schools, which have also appreciated that the industrial kind of construct of the 30-person box is a little bit of a 19th century solution to mass education, as the best of those start to reinvent much more dynamic spaces. But it does require an absolutely fundamental change in how we're delivering learning. I'll give you a little example which I'm less embarrassed about talking publicly now that the age of the MOOC is with us. In this kind of lectures, in the space that I've kind of described, we had some students who took a University of Melbourne course by downloading a science course from another university in America, sat round in a group of five people watching the you know the lectures, chatted to each other, found a tutor, got updated on those things, turned up to the exams and did very well. They had effectively disintermediated a large part of kind of the infrastructure of a university. Now that can be seen as threat or massive opportunity because it said both place still is incredibly important. It mattered that five people could get together and have a trust-based collaborative experience. It mattered that they could find someone to have an interaction with them. And the sheer kind of nature of place mattered, but the content came from somewhere else. So I think we've got to be really careful as we do this reinvention, to do it around new ways of learning, and not to be caught in an either-or, that it's either the MOOC or the place. I, in fact, think in lots of ways there will be many segments of these things, but for universities like ours, it'll be the coming together that offers the biggest kind of chances for genuine revolution.
Well, I just might point out that I think the very first space that Peter transformed here on campus was a lecture theatre in chemistry, transformed to a very different space, and we will see more of that, and the opportunity of that the changes in online provision present are exactly the ones that Rufus has described. That there will be so inherently it's a social experience doing education. We have to create the kind of spaces where students can engage in that learning, but it will be different. So, however, we do need lecture theatres for public lectures and conferences. So it's getting that balance right. But the students are voting with their feet in terms of attendance at lectures. So that's the most telling, I think, statistic is when you start looking at attendance in week three.
Oh, sorry, question in the middle, please.
Given that the planning for facilities, major facilities, certainly is 4 to 5 years hence, and we're currently looking at those now, what are the panel's suggestions for those that are involved in that planning and subsequently involved in the construction, which will happen maybe in 3 or 4 years' time, on where we're actually headed at the end of the day? I mean, we're talking about today and things are moving along, but where are we actually going? What sort of things should those that are in that field be looking at to provide that level of support?
Rufus articulated quite a number of them, and it will be also, but I think the one that the physical infrastructure for online connectedness is a big change that, you know, we need to be thinking about the bring your own device model, and we don't even know what the devices are going to be. But it's really about creating collaborative spaces and thinking through how best to do that and learning from that. I think the change has kind of happened. And so in the sense of what we what you saw just in the Ormond College example, but there are many others in that. So I'd be looking to recent examples, I guess.
I suppose what I'm actually asking is what you see as the next step. I mean, that change has happened, and Peter's doing a lot of work around that now and yourselves. But do you see what the next change is likely to be?
Could I make a suggestion? Not my business, but I'd like to make it anyway. The point I didn't make, but I was hoping would come through the presentation that I made, is this city is a learning space. And I think the university should frankly take advantage of that. And the way in which it configures itself, the way in which it conducts what it does, take advantage of the fact that you are sitting in an incredible learning economy, learning space with lots and lots of people coming in and out of it every day. And the other thing is that these numbers are starting to come out from Austin's survey of whatever the knowledge sector is about collaboration. I think it says to me that a really important thing for people to learn to take part in this workforce is socialisation. How do you do it? How do you do it well? So I think...
Tiff, can I intervene there? Because there's something that hasn't come out in any of the questions so far and the presentations really, and I thought it might. And that concerns the enormous number of international students we have in the city.
Yep.
We welcome them. But my question to all of you would be, what could we do better to integrate and engage with that large number of people? And is there an architectural or urban design response required to do it better?
Before we get on to that, there's just an ingredient I'd like to throw into the mix in relation to this really great question about how we plan, what we do to plan. Because I think there is a little danger we don't get all the right people around the table to get this right. My experience of this is it is actually a sustained conversation between the educators, the designers, but also the orchestrators of community, particularly where we've got, you know, a university of nearly 50,000 people. Spaces work because of the way they relate to the particular community that interacts with them. And unless we put some serious thought into how we design community around here so that we actually get groups of people who have enough interaction with each other that they build the qualities of relational connection, that serendipity can happen, that the deeper conversations can occur. We could easily design spaces that the educators and the designers think are going to work, but which actually are socially unsuccessful because we haven't rethought how community works. So I'm a little nervous that we do have to, I think, rebuild lots of aspects of our spaces, but I'm not sure yet that all the right people are around the table puzzling away, and that it's become as central as it needs to be to, if you like, the university, to the broad university city reform agenda. I think there are very new partnerships and relationships, and reinventing the learning and the community need to happen with a quite different level of intensity. But I'll just back to international students.
If we could just pick up the focus on the international students, would we engage better with them? Could we integrate them better into our lives and into our city through better architectural or urban design interventions?
I'm not sure that it actually is architecture and urban design. I think it's more about care, welcoming and community inclusiveness. There are 100,000 people who live in the city of Melbourne, reside in the city of Melbourne, go to sleep in the city of Melbourne. 42% of them, from memory, are tertiary students. Of those, Austin, help me, how many are international? 16,000 international students living in this community. So 16% of our residential community are international students. So they might be here for 3, 4, 5 years and gone. So the chances are of them missing the opportunity to be part of this community are relatively high. Issues to be concerned about: housing. You know, the quality of housing. Is there any exploitation happening in housing? It's something that we actually have to pay attention to in all sorts of ways that you may not necessarily even hear about the occasional example of someone exploiting students by packing too many of them into spaces, rendering it unsafe. We actually have to go in and take action on that, prosecute about it. It doesn't make the front pages, but we have to do it. We have to be concerned about the design and planning of housing. So the council has developed policies around what is student housing, essentially to get away from exploitation of people who may not be here long enough to demand it themselves. The city provides welcoming days for international students. Welcome, be part of our community. I mean, we do work with the universities and the other tertiary education providers to do that. We probably have to keep doing it better, because if they decide not to come, it'll cost us all one way or another.
Could I get a brief response from the other two panelists? Yeah.
As colleges, we've learned a lot about this. A number of us would have up to 20% international students. There are two things I think that have gone missing in the way we're dealing with them in the city, is we have concentrations far greater than that. In fact, many residential areas will not be an adequately diversified mix, which inevitably impedes integration. The second piece is we don't do enough to actually create community building spaces and facilities and structures around these things. So, and that's partly because as a city and as a university, we have not committed in the way other universities and all the great universities have to a residential component as an integral part of a university experience. Unless we do that, we will end up with the reality of effectively closed, unduly closed communities, which are an unhealthy part, both for those part of them and for the wider city. To fix this problem, it requires the university and the city to find models where we can really create a very different kind, and collaboration with RMIT and others, Victoria University, all of who have interests in the city, a very different kind of residential setting than the current ones that are dished up by commercial providers.
Margaret, would you like to find a word?
I'll just make two comments. One is that the train line will provide opportunities, if the metro goes ahead, provide us with more opportunities for housing, because we're not then confined to this necessarily very expensive precinct. And the second one is just a reflection on a comment that I had from the Provost at Ohio State when I visited there recently, and they've just moved, Rufus, to have all of first year and second year accommodated on campus. And interestingly, the people that complained were the exploiting landlords in the surrounding area. And he's a very colourful president, the president of Ohio State. And he said, well, if you'd treated your tenants properly, we wouldn't have had to move in this direction. So there's certainly more thinking to do around that. And I think, Rufus and Jeff have identified a range of those issues.
Thank you, Margaret. Thank you to each of you. Could I ask you to join me in thanking the panellists today for their efforts?